You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow, and for the rest of the hour, as I said, we're going to be talking about the heart disease, and interesting topics that are coming out of the gathering in New Orleans of the American Heart Association, where a lot of doctors, cardiologists, researchers have gathered this week to chew the fat with their fellow doctors. Well, maybe it's a bad choice of words when you're talking about heart disease, but they were talking a lot, and on their agenda, just about everything new in heart disease prevention, detection, treatment, including a look at the eating habits of people living in poor neighborhoods, surprising results from a study of people who took vitamin E supplements. Many of you take those supplements, and there's some news, interesting news, a warning about that that came out of the meeting. Also, a new approach to controlling cholesterol, and even a very high-tech yet simple, low-tech way to treat heart failure by encasing the heart in sort of a mesh stocking, you know, sort of support hose for the heart. It's kind of interesting. We'll talk about that one a little bit later. But first, let me introduce my first two guests. Dr. Paula Johnson is a cardiologist. She is chief of the Division of Women's Health at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. She joins us by phone. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Johnson.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Robert Eckel is professor at the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center in Denver. He's also president-elect of the American Heart Association. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Eckel.
Thank you very much.
Let me begin with you, Dr. Eckel. What do you think is the most exciting thing to come out of the meeting this week?
Well, actually, coming from this from a perspective of metabolic diseases, which we know is so important to heart disease, I think the symposium on the metabolic syndrome was really very informative about the importance of that issue and its impact on the practice of medicine. And related to that, I think there are some things that were presented that were promising. I think the potential of a new weight loss drug, Rimonabant, was discussed in detail. And
let's talk about that. I'll just stop you along the way and go through a little. Let's talk about that weight loss drug. We've heard about it. It seemed almost like a miracle drug.
Yeah, miracle's probably offering a little bit too much in terms of what we know about this compound at this point in time. You know, interestingly enough, this drug was used initially to help people stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And when ultimately patients were studied on this, yes, a significant percentage did stop smoking and were successful in maintaining that. Weight loss was seen. And going back to the animal database, one examined the possibility that the mechanisms of action of this drug could impact weight regulation. And so another look, a new venue, allowed this drug now to be studied in a number of patients. We now have over 6,000 people who've been examined on this compound, both in Europe and the United States. And the recent data presented at the American Heart related to the two-year experience of this compound in reducing weight and risk factors for cardiovascular disease.
Any side effects?
Well, the side effects were few. There was some nausea, I guess, during the initial period of implementation. And then, secondarily, there were a few people who, I guess, got quite a bit depressed on the compound, but not a large number. So the side effect profile looked pretty good. But the important information is if you're on the drug and lose weight over the first year, which was, by the way, about 7% beyond placebo. So this is a compound that's going to compare at least favorably, if not better, than any other drug we have available for weight reduction. If you stopped it at a year, you regained the weight. But if you continued it for 2 years, the effect was sustained.
Did you have to keep taking it even, or it was only studied for 2 years?
2 years, yes.
From what I understand, this drug works by blocking the quote-unquote pleasure center of the brain. Is that right?
That's right. The endocannabinoid system is a system in the brain that relates to kind of flight for life, pleasure, comfort, relaxation, and lots of things that relate to long-term regulatory systems that are involved in the body's kind of steady state.
So isn't it sort of a psychiatric drug?
It is. And, you know, one concern I have, and I know that the data thus far don't speak to this, but if, in fact, you're modifying a system that's so important and feeling comfortable and good, is that going to have a downside in people that may have a pre-existing tendency to psychiatric disease? And I think that's more of a question right now than it is an answer.
So has the drug, do you have to get okay for it to be re-released, or is it going to come out anyhow before we even know the answers to this question?
Well, there's not an NDA that's been submitted yet. That won't occur until probably early to mid next year. But yes, right now the company hasn't portrayed a great concern over this. But I think with any other new drug, you know, we've got to have a more broadening experience before we have the final line on that.
Well, we've got to watch this carefully.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Dr. Johnson, you looked at people in the poor neighborhoods of Boston and whether they have access to quote-unquote heart-healthy foods, and you found that it's very hard for anybody on food stamps to eat a good heart-healthy diet. Right?
Right, we did. I mean, I think that the current lead-in in talking about obesity and the significant problem of obesity, you know, I think that we would like to think about going to other therapies when healthy eating and physical activity, those kind of quote-unquote simple things we can do, fail. And we wanted to really look at the affordability of heart-healthy eating for a low-income population. And what we found was that both for a kind of single older adult as well as for a family of four, that the current food stamp benefit was not really adequate. And not only wasn't the current food stamp benefit adequate, but if we looked at even a more generous standard that tends not to be used generally, but a more realistic standard, mm-hmm. such as the Massachusetts Economic Efficiency Standard, that it still wasn't affordable according to that.
You actually prepared, I read the study, but you actually prepared grocery lists that people should buy. What sort of things should they get, and what did they have, and why couldn't they get what they needed?
Well, what we did was we spent quite a bit of time with two groups, focus groups of women who frequently make the eating decisions in their household, and we looked at the menus that they tend to eat mm-hmm. on a regular basis, and then we worked with our dietitians to really translate those into more healthy options, but healthy options that people would actually eat. So I think it's very important to think about, you know, not just trading off for something that nobody would really put in their mouths, but something that's reasonable and tasteful. And, you know, for example, if you look at having fried fish, you know, and kind of fried haddock, which is some of the things that some of the women were cooking, and trade that off with kind of a pan-fried or a lightly sautéed catfish, you know, that's a better option. Or if you were going to have macaroni and cheese, that, you know, 4 ounces of baked chicken might be a better option. And we also looked at making sure that these menus were also easy to prepare, because people are on a very tight time schedule. People are frequently working more than one job. And the food had to be accessible. You know, had to be able to get the food in your neighborhood.
But you found that, you know, just taking those two menus, a chicken is a lot more expensive than the food that they were eating before that you compared it to, right?
It is more expensive when you start talking about fruits and vegetables.
Right.
Those what we call energy dense foods are more expensive than the higher caloric kind of more energy dense foods. And I think another take home message here is that when we as physicians are sitting in our offices with patients and we talk to them about healthy diets, we really have to think about this in the context of people's lives, and the choices they make are sometimes not the choices that they would necessarily mm-hmm. make, but some of the choices that they're forced into making.
But you say anyhow, even if they wanted to make these other healthy choices, the food stamps are not going to cover it.
If you are on a full food stamp benefit, that is exactly right. It mm-hmm. is not going to cover it.
Any answer to that?
Well, we have a lot of work to do. You know, I think the ultimate answer would be to really think about how do we make foods more affordable in our country. And I think that one of the things is to think about increasing the food stamp benefit. That's in a tight budgetary time, that is difficult. I think there are things we can do in the meantime, though. For example, if you think about fresh fruits and vegetables, farmers markets are wonderful opportunities for people in local areas to support local growers. At this point, the food stamp benefit mm-hmm. is frequently not able to be used at farmers markets. Those are things that on a local level we can do. The other thing I think we also need to do, this is one study in one area of Boston. We're repeating it in another Latino area, but we need to take this both to the state level as well as nationally and understand what it takes to eat in our country.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let me bring in another doctor. Dr. Douglas Mann is a cardiologist at Baylor College of Medicine in Dallas. Welcome to Science Friday.
Actually, we're in Houston. The Houstonians get upset.
I'm sorry. Oh, I said Dallas, didn't I?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I don't want to do that. I know the rivalry there.
Yeah.
Welcome. Now, I understand that you have come up with a sort of a low-tech, high-tech method for treating heart failure using like a mesh stocking, I call it, like, you know, hose, you know, support hose on a heart to treat for heart failure?
That's the basic concept. First of all, I didn't invent this. I was just the principal investigator mm-hmm. in the trial. But the concept goes back to an observation that started years ago with therapies where we used to use skeletal myoplasty, or we would use these skeletal muscle wraps around the heart, and they would be stimulated with a pacemaker to help the skeletal muscle contract and improve cardiac output that way. And what they noticed that when the pacemaker was turned off, that the hearts actually got better, the pressures inside the hearts went down. And this then led the light to go off in a very clever engineer's head that maybe passive support of the heart, or passive girdling, if you will, would actually reduce stress in the heart and allow the heart to heal. So based on that, they designed this so-called core cap cardiac support device, which looks very much like a mesh stocking, and it's surgically implanted around the ventricles, or the pumping chambers of the heart, and provides gentle support to the heart in diastole when the heart relaxes. And when they've done calculations on how it works, it actually reduces wall stress, which is a primary determinant for what makes the heart grow bigger. So that's how the concept all originally evolved. And then a lot of preclinical testing in animal models showed that not only would this device keep the heart from getting bigger, it made the heart actually get smaller. So that's what the basis for the trial was.
Wow. And so is this now routinely being used, or do you have to... get okay for this?
We need to get okay, as they say. So the company which developed it, Acorn Cardiovascular in St. Paul, Minnesota, will file with the FDA this December, and we hope to go forward to the FDA in the first quarter of 2005 and gain regulatory approval.
Do you have to go through the regular type of open heart surgery to have this mesh put on?
A great question. It does require that the chest be opened, a so-called thoracotomy. It does not require necessarily that the heart be stopped or that the heart be opened. Although I'm not a cardiac surgeon, my surgical colleagues tell me that this procedure is actually trivial.
So it's less stress then on the heart.
Yeah, the concept again is that by applying gentle support, pressure to the outside, you relieve the pressures inside. Moreover, the sort of mechanical properties of the sock, if you will, encourage the heart to regain a more normal shape. The failing heart assumes a shape much like a basketball. The normal heart is more like a football. And for a variety of technical reasons, the change in shape creates a number of mechanical burdens for the heart. So the sock encourages the heart to regain a more normal shape and a smaller size, which just makes it more efficient overall.
Hmm. And I guess it would be cheaper than having open heart surgery.
Again, I'm not an economist. Yeah. I can't tell you how this procedure will be priced or what the costs will be, but I would think it would be less than a bypass surgery for sure.
Well, let me go on to one other before we go to the phones. Let me go back to Dr. Eckel. There was also news out of the meeting about the possible dangers of vitamin E, taking too high a dosage of vitamin E. And it's been since it's been released, a lot of people have been talking about that. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of that study?
Well, absolutely. A little bit of history here is that, through uncontrolled trial evidence, it was assumed that vitamin E supplementation might be beneficial. And unfortunately, when the scientific foundation of a statement is there, we don't really have the answer until randomized trials are carried out. And so what the group at Hopkins did, I think, is take the published clinical trials comparing vitamin C supplementation to placebo, and I think they examined 14 studies in the last decade to come up with their findings. And they looked at dosages that range from approximately 15 to several 1,000 units a day, up to 2,000 actually, with an average intake of 400 international units. And actually what they came up with was the fact that vitamin E is not beneficial, and from the recent trials that we've seen, we haven't seen any clear benefit of vitamin E in people with existing heart disease. But what they did find in the meta-analysis, and a meta-analysis is a way of pulling clinical trials together with certain arbitrary criteria to include them or exclude them, and that was carried out by the Hopkins group. What they found is that if you were on doses above 400 international units a day, there was a suggested modest harm to taking the vitamin E. So many of us in our clinics for some time now have discouraged people from taking supplements, but that they should be eating right, lots of fruits and vegetables and whole grains, but yet people continue to take supplements. And I think this study is important because it may indicate that maybe the lack of evidence is also potentially more than that, and that people could be harming themselves.
Quite interesting. Thank you for telling us about this. Listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, I'm Ira Flatow from NPR News. Because a lot of people who take 400, 800 units, it's not uncommon for health food people or supplement people to take this kind of dosage.
very common.
Yeah. There have been criticisms of the study that there are not enough people in it, that it should be, you should have expanded it or should be expanded to study this more. Do you think this will be repeated?
Well, this is a meta-analysis, so it's kind of the state of the art right now where the field's at.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can go to the phones and see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Sue in Wisconsin. Hi, Sue.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a comment and then a question for Dr. Johnson, and I'll take my answer off the air. For some obvious political reasons, it seems that when we talk about a heart-healthy diet, we are very afraid to suggest that people eat a vegetarian diet. And my question is, whether when the assessment was done of the food stamp program, whether they factored in a diet that would be vegetarian using beans, legumes, and grains instead of meat protein. And I appreciate you
yeah.
answering.
I think that is a good question. And in this particular study, what we really tried to do was work within kind of the cultural context of the group that we were working with, and vegetarianism wasn't an attractive option. But I think the point of this type of work is to think about, for many different types of groups, including those for whom a vegetarian diet would be a very good option that you would actually consume, really what would it take to eat a healthy vegetarian diet, once again rich in fruits and vegetables. And I think it was just interesting here, we were talking about vitamin E and the dangers of supplementation in large doses and going back to, once again, eating a healthy diet. And I think it just once again brings home the point how important it is that we make healthy foods and healthy choices accessible to every American.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Eckel, before we go to the break, you mentioned right at the beginning of a fair number of sessions were dealt on metabolic syndrome. Can you give us a quick idea of what that is?
Yeah, the metabolic syndrome is a set of criteria that relate to an increased risk of heart disease and diabetes, and it includes a big waist, and there are criteria for men and women that differ. It's a low HDL cholesterol or good cholesterol. It's a high triglyceride. It's a blood pressure above 130 over 85. And finally, it's a glucose level that can be elevated or modestly elevated. The issue is related to the presence of three or more of those criteria making up the metabolic syndrome. And now that represents about 27% of U.S. citizens.
Wow. That's a lot of people.
It is.
All right. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about news coming from the Heart Association meeting. Take more of your phone calls and talk about more kinds of issues like this new study that talks about treating African Americans versus everybody. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about heart disease prevention and treatment with new information that has been coming out this week at the American Heart Association meeting. With my guest, Dr. Paula Johnson of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Dr. Robert Eckel, President-elect of the American Heart Association, Dr. Douglas Mann, a cardiologist at Baylor College in Houston. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And before I left, I was talking, and I'll address this to Dr. Johnson. There was an interesting paper that came out that's been getting a lot of stir. And one of the reasons it's been causing a stir at the meeting is a study that looked at two drugs, a combination treatment to treat diseases in African Americans. And they had an astounding rate of success. I think death rate fell by 43% in the study from heart failure.
Right.
And people have been saying, why was this just studied on African Americans instead of the whole population? Are we now into, you know, creating racial drugs?
Well, I think the answer is no. We are not into creating racial drugs. And the history as to why this combination drug, which is really a combination of two very old drugs, isosorbide dinitrate and hydralazine in combination, these drugs had been tested in older studies. And when the investigators went back and looked at how different subpopulations did, it looked as if the smaller African-American population may have actually had some increased benefit to being treated with these two drugs. And so the idea was to take this combination drug, which has been patented by a company, Nitromed, and actually test it in a randomized group of self-identified black patients. And the trial was actually stopped early. Mm-hmm. And this does bring up a big question, because is this now just a drug to be used in self-identified black patients? And I think, in my mind, what this says is that it points to potentially a mechanism underlying congestive heart failure that needs to be looked at across populations, that it will not be every black person for whom this drug will be the drug, but that it opens a door for us to look mechanistically at congestive heart failure across all populations and to better understand scientifically how we treat this this disease. And we also know it's very important to not mistake this particular study in terms of saying that race is a genetically based factor. We know that it is not.
Mm-hmm. So there's no reason then to target this medication at blacks who may be suffering from heart failure?
Well, the drug was tested in a population of black patients. Mm-hmm. So the next step, honestly, should be a large trial in which we try to understand not only the underlying mechanism of heart failure, but in which we test it in a more recent group of diverse patients. Because the initial studies of these drugs were done a number of years ago when the treatment of congestive heart failure was quite different. We've come a long way in treating patients with different types of drugs, for example, with ACE inhibitors.
Right. So we might have missed that in the original study.
We really might have missed it. So I think that to have this be the take-home message that it's only good for one population is not the right message.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Sherry in Salt Lake City. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I am a mother of two boys, and my husband is a full-time student, and we have been on food stamps for an amount of time. And I just want to refute the comment that was made that it's not a sufficient amount of money to eat healthily and live a healthy lifestyle. During this amount of time, I've also lost a lot of weight, 70 pounds, actually.
What's an average dinner like for you on food stamps?
You know, we'll have rice and chicken, but it's not, like, lean or whatever. It's not super healthy. It's just that we'll add extra vegetables and the cream of mushroom soup, or say that's a dinner. And then maybe once a week we'll do frozen pizza, but I think that maybe the group that she was studying ate more prepared foods. I don't know what it is.
Let me ask Dr. Johnson to jump in here.
I think that the population that we're looking at is, and what we were studying is not the affordability if you're using food stamps to supplement a current income. We're looking at for those people who rely on food stamps in terms of the total benefit. So I think it's a subset of the population. I think what you're pointing out is something that's in fact very, very important, which is that as food stamps are used as a supplement, it can be incredibly important for people to access that type of benefit. And we need to do a better job at that. In Massachusetts, slightly over 50% of the people who are eligible actually do access the benefits. So I think we need to do a much better job there. And I think we also have to look at healthy eating in the context of people's neighborhoods and what they have accessible to them. So, for example, many people live in neighborhoods without grocery stores, with small markets, without fresh fruits and vegetables, and when they are there, they're poor quality and quite expensive. So I think that's why I say it's very important to take this type of work and take it to both other urban areas and rural areas and also in other parts of the country with different racial and ethnic groups.
Okay,
with people with different preferences.
Well, I want to make one more quick comment that I don't think that an increase in the amount of money given is the answer, but I do think increased education would be a better answer, and also to your comment about having access to local markets, to farmers markets and things, that would be wonderful.
Yes, absolutely.
It would be wonderful.
And education is very important, and I think we need to really develop much better partnerships between the medical world and the public health world about how we actually get this type of message in a realistic way in which people can act on it to the people that we serve.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck. 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Eckel, there was a fair amount of news related this week to treating diabetes that was presented at the meeting. Give us some highlights of what some of those studies were.
Well, there were two studies, I think, that are important, Ira. The first is Gemini, which was a comparison of two beta blockers, which are commonly used in people with hypertension and or heart disease. This study was targeted at hypertension, and these people had diabetes. Metoprolol, which is kind of a standard generic beta blocker used for decades, was compared to carvedilol, which is a trade name, more expensive drug. And what the study showed was on carvedilol, there tended to be a modest deterioration in blood sugar, whereas with carvedilol, that did not occur. So if I said that incorrectly, metoprolol is associated with an increasing blood glucose. Carvedilol was not. And in a subset of patients, there was a significant increase, like greater than 0.5 to 1% in the glycosylated hemoglobin, which is a test to assess overall diabetes control. So the conclusion of the study was that if you've got diabetes and you need a beta blocker, perhaps carvedilol might be a safer choice than metoprolol. I think there are issues that can be raised about that conclusion that we could discuss. But nevertheless, that was the finding.
Take it up with your own doctor when you go in there.
Absolutely.
Let me bring one question to Dr. Mann about the mesh covering, this, the sock on the mesh stocking on the heart. Why doesn't the heart reject this, you know, as a foreign substance?
Well, because it's basically a synthetic weave that has no antigenic properties from the standpoint of the body. Much like we use Dacron grafts today in the vascular system for aortic aneurysms, this is basically a synthetic weave that the body doesn't regard as foreign.
So you just leave it there and it stays?
It becomes a part of you.
It
actually works by being fibrosed over and being incorporated into the heart, and actually it's closer to you than you are in many ways. So it actually becomes part of you. It's not a drug. It's not an electrical therapy. It literally becomes part of the human heart.
Is it elastic and get smaller with the heart and keep the pressure on?
It's a synthetic weave. It's not quite elastic. And it doesn't compress the heart in a firm way. It applies gentle diastolic support to the heart. And over time, that compression, we looked very carefully for what we call cardiac constriction, which would be a complication. And we found that there were no real adverse events directly related to it. So that was one of the concerns going into the trial.
A lot of people who have heart failure have bad valves in their hearts. Will this help them?
We think, so part of the trial actually is a great question, incorporated people who have mitral regurgitation or a leaky mitral valve. And in those people, they did quite well with the cardiac support device. And the original design of the whole trial was to just do it in those people alone. And then as we began to see stronger efficacy signals, we also looked at people just on medical therapy. So the device could be used very easily with people with mitral regurgitation, and it will stabilize the repairs.
Terrific. 1-800-989-8255 is the number. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Does it need any you know, next generation of heart mesh, or is this working well enough? Or are you working on the next kind of thing?
We're going forward to the FDA. I think it took probably about 6 years to get to where we are now. So I think that the first step is to get FDA approval. I think over time that the direction will be to miniaturize the technology and do it through a less invasive surgical procedure.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Lou in Allentown, PA. Hi, Lou.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I have two questions. The one directed at Dr. Mann. Had you written a book about you can prevent heart disease?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Did you write a book called You Can Prevent Heart Disease?
No, we've written a number of books, but that's not one of the titles.
Okay. There was something about cortisol in it. Is that what you're referring to when you say that one of the metabolic factors where the weight is increased around the waist with excess cortisol?
Well, that was Dr. Eckel who said
that.
Ask Dr. Eckel on it.
Sorry.
That's in my turf, Lou. Definitely increases in cortisol can increase your waist circumference, yes.
Okay. My other question was about vitamin E. Along with C, I thought vitamin E was also an antioxidant.
It is, Lou.
And I think at one point it was suggested that if you took vitamin E a week or two before having an operation, that would help you to heal faster.
No, Lou, that's actually not been clearly demonstrated. You know, many of the antioxidant properties of these vitamins are really test tube events. It doesn't mean they don't work in the body. It just means that the studies that have been carried out where these agents have been given versus no treatment, that the benefit hasn't been clearly seen.
You must have heard from the vitamin E people already by now. Imagine the vitamin industry.
Yes, my emails have been frequent on this matter, for sure. And this is not my study. They should really be going to Edgar Miller at Hopkins, not me.
Because this is, you know, this is legendary, how taking vitamin E, you know, is part of your daily regimen.
Well, I think the message the American Heart Association would like to get it across, of course, the AHA did not publish this abstract, nor did it comment on it directly, but the issue is eating right. I think Dr. Johnson mentioned that again earlier.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Johnson, will you be getting any follow-ups on your studies?
Well, as I said, we are doing this in another neighborhood with a Latino group of women, and then we are actually going to be taking this to our state legislators as well as other partners in public health and really trying to see if we can come up with some solutions and also repeat the study both, as I said, to statewide and also think about doing something like this nationally. You know, there are solutions, and I think it's about partnership and making healthy eating and accessibility to food a real priority.
If you can get those bigger markets to bring in their stuff and, you know, where you can get to it.
Absolutely.
Brings the prices down.
It's bigger supermarkets,
yeah.
But it's also there are opportunities for significant partnership to also get healthy foods into smaller markets. In Oakland, California, they've done this. There are models, wonderful models around the country. Here in Boston, Boston Medical Center does an outstanding job of helping people to eat healthy through the hospital. And I think that there are a number of models that we need to just really look at around the country.
Interesting meeting, Dr. Eckel.
Yes, I think so.
And next year, I'm sure it'll be even bigger.
Well, we hope.
Go ahead.
Dallas next year.
Dallas. Not Houston. I want to thank you.
We're working on it.
Okay, Doug.
Thank you all for taking time to talk with me. Dr. Robert Eckel, President-elect of the American Heart Association, Dr. Paula Johnson of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston.
Thank you.
And Dr. Douglas Mann at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Thanks again.
Thank you.
For taking time to talk with us.
Bye, Ira.
Thank you. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and Senior Producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer and our director, and our interns are Corey Binns and Abby Leonard. A lot of information today, in case if you missed any of it and you want to, you know, check back on it, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have all those interesting links to it. We also have back editions of Science Friday that you can download on your iPod or listen to them on your Real Audio player. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection. We'll take the show and we'll make teaching material out of it, free teaching material. Just go to the website at sciencefriday.com and just click on the little button on the left that says Teachers. And we have teaching material even from years ago of Science Friday. If you want to take them out and teach them in your class, you're more than welcome to. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.